It is 27 minutes after the hour on a therapeutic, now theological Thursday, since Pastor Robbie Pruitt has joined us from Ashburn, Virginia. Robbie's an Anglican pastor, a member of the board at Preserving Bible Times. And boy, you've been busy with Preserving Bible Times here lately. Just a constant.
Well, so have you. Yeah, we've been having a good time over at PBT, getting a lot done. Thanks for having me on, Jim and David. Good to be on the broken road with you this morning.
Well, we expect to learn something. I don't want to put any pressure on you, Robbie, but there are people hanging on every word here. After last week was so good, just so good, and the meaning of the vineyard and the owner and the workers. I mean, you just did that so well and applied context so ably that our expectations are high today. And now we're going into the next chapter, Matthew 21, and the parable of the two sons, which has nothing to do with prodigal. We're back in the vineyard, aren't we?
Absolutely. When we hear the two sons, we automatically think about the prodigal sons. Certainly those parables in Luke 15. But this is a parable in Matthew's gospel about the vineyard. And I want to look a little bit at vineyards because I think it's important. One of the ideas I've been kicking around lately and some of the research that I've been doing personally really spun off of some of my time. Monday night, I was training some of the docents and living history interpreters over at Museum of the Bible in biblical context. And one of the points that I was making kind of lightly, but then started to think more about, was this idea that the text reveals its context. So where do we get this biblical context from? It's the stuff between the lines. How do we get there? How do we know contextual realities? And one of the observations that I've been making is that the text reveals the context that we need to know, not all the time, but certainly some of the time, to make sense of other passages. Let me give you an example that will help us even today. Deuteronomy. So in Moses's fifth book, his final speech from the Torah, Deuteronomy chapter 6, we get a couple of verses about the land, the promised land. Deuteronomy 6, 10 through 11, it says, "Then it shall come about when the Lord your God brings you into the land which he swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you. Great and splendid cities which you did not build, and houses full of all good things which you did not fill, and hewn cisterns which you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant, and you eat and are satisfied." So in the God's covenant, God's promise with his people, he's promised to give them this land. So this is where we get the term promised land. And vineyards are an important part of their inheritance. Why is this land so lush? Why is it so promising? It's because the infrastructure has been constructed and built. Infrastructure like vineyards and wine presses are there. So they're inheriting this land from the Canaanites, and vineyards are often metaphors for God's kingdom. The vineyard owner is a metaphor for God himself. The vineyard workers, well, hey, that's us. We're all renters. We're all stewards in the vineyard. So the text kind of gives us insight into other passages when we start tracing themes of, say, vineyard, and begin to look at that theme, we begin to reach the depths of even these parables that we're talking about today.
You prompted another thought, and probably more properly a question here, because I know about the land of milk and honey, and I'm wondering if Moses' words about vineyards and orchards and trees didn't also refer to geography, because at the time, they were in the desert. I mean, desperate, dry, empty, barren land, if you've ever seen the pictures of the Negev. But if he mentions vineyards, they must have said, well, hey, that's a lot better than where we are, and it must include Galilee region in the northern part of Israel, where there is lush green stuff. That must have been heartwarming to hear to them, I would think.
I would think so too. And when you begin to look at the land, you're talking 100, 150 feet from north to south, 100, 150 miles north to south, and 50 miles wide. The land's broken up into sections. You've got the coastal plain down by the coast. You've got the hill country. You've got the mountainous region, and then you have the wilderness down by the Jordan Rift Valley and then east of that. And, of course, the Israelites were being released from slavery in Egypt. They were crossing the Red Sea. They were in the wilderness wandering around. So when you think about a land flowing with milk and honey, to your point, or if you think about Deuteronomy and this covenant, this promise, you see that there has to be green, there has to be mountains. Take, for instance, the Philistines, someone like Samson, who's hanging out with the Philistines down in the coastal plain and in the hill country, the Shephelah is what they call it, the coastal plain, the Shephelah, the hill country, the ridge, the mountain region, and then the desert. Well, if Samson's hanging out there with the Philistines, they're, wheat and barley harvest are abundant, and the Philistines are actually beer drinkers. You need to get up into the mountain region where there are vineyards, and there the Israelites are wine drinkers. So even your geography affects the food you eat, and of course your beverage of choice.
Well, let me riff on that for just a second, because just last Sunday we had a fairly long teaching video from Dr. Randy Smith, who mentioned how difficult life was, how it took five working the field full time to feed six, and you're one insect infestation, one drought away from famine. And the reason, especially from Egypt on up, that beer was so prominent, it was calories.
Mm-hmm.
It was caloric. It's maybe what you had to survive on during the winter, for example. I mean, it wasn't just, we have the notion of a relaxing drink, a time in a bar and beer and wine, but it was survival to those people.
Absolutely. And even in the archaeology, I mean, Biblical Archaeology Review has done an entire spread article on beer making, and this idea that in the archaeology is the vats that were used to make beer. And we have some of these at Museum of the Bible. The IAA does, the Israeli Antiquities Authority, has these implements to make beer in the archaeological record, and they're on display at Museum of the Bible. So this is kind of the context that the land, where you live affects your diet and what you eat, what you drink. And so certainly this parable, the vineyard, Israel is often referred to as the vine. And this is where we get like John 15, and we get the idea that Jesus is saying, I am the vine, you are the branches. And so Israel is supposed to be this lush place. And then we get fig trees planted in vineyards. We get olive trees planted in vineyards. We begin to see the pairing of the agriculture and how farmers are planting and growing crops and beginning to make sense of all of that.
And the Israelites were agrarian people. I mean, even their history before, when they went into bondage, they were sheep herders. And that's what made them so useful to Egypt in the beginning. And they were given the land of Goshen, which was sheep and pastures. And so that was their background. They understood those terms, vineyards and trees and orchards.
Right. And even God's coming kingdom is referred to when it's spoken about. It's that one day everybody's going to sit under their own vine and fig tree. We're going to have prosperity. We're going to have fruit to eat, wine to drink. And so we see this in Jeremiah, for thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, houses and fields and vineyards will again be brought in this land, bought in this land. So this is Jeremiah 32:15, promise of restoration in the face of exile. And then Jeremiah 35:6-10, but they said, we will not drink wine. So this idea that's a sorrow or grief, not being able to drink wine.
Yeah, note there, I've learned that the word for wine in Hebrew is the same word for happiness.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a joyous occasion. We've got a recreation of a wine press in the village of Jesus of Nazareth in the Museum of the Bible. And one of our talking points is when we're in there is, you know, the women and the children will wash their feet and enter into the upper chamber. The harvesters will bring in the grapes, and the men will play the harps on the hillside. And there's dancing and singing and rejoicing, for making wine is a joyous occasion. And we drink wine at joyous occasions. Say wedding feast, and you begin to make sense of like Cana of Galilee and John chapter 2 and the first a miracle of Jesus. And even in Ezekiel, you see this this promise of security and blessing in drinking wine. In Ezekiel 28:26, they will live in security. They will build houses and plant vineyards and live securely when I execute judgments upon all who scorn them around about, and they will know that I am the Lord your God. So when God promises blessing, when God promises provision, when God promises security, when God promises prosperity, wine and vineyards are often knitted together with his kingdom and his kingdom work.
And those same agrarian themes carry through into the New Testament, and the Gospels are rife with them, with agrarian references. And so I guess if we're going to understand that culture, you have to understand that they were people of the land.
Absolutely. And you can get that in the text. The text tells you, not only just with Jesus's teaching, the abundance of agricultural references, the abundance of farming stories, and these workers in the vineyard, and the sower who went out to sow in his field. I mean, this gives you realities of what were some of the enemies against a fruitful crop. You know, certainly the birds of the air, the type of soil, and you begin to make sense of all this agriculture, which is a huge part of the context in the first century, and it's part that I think in the 21st century, it's foreign to us, this farming, unless, of course, you have a little homestead farm somewhere. I mean, I just went to a prayer breakfast this morning, the Loudoun Community Prayer Breakfast in Loudoun County, Virginia, and I was next to a sheep farmer, for crying out loud. This guy just bought a little homestead, and he was planting a garden. And this gentleman knew more at the table than any of the rest of us about the first century context simply by what he was dabbling in with his hobby farm. For me, I got insight into the first century context and some of these agricultural realities when my wife and I moved to Haiti. Haiti still has an agrarian culture, I mean, an agrarian society. You can go up in the mountains and live like those who lived in the first century. You could stay in a stone home, and you can walk the fields, and you can bring in the harvest, and you can draw water out of a well or a cistern. You can go up on a flat roof at night and enjoy the cool of the evening. All of these things are embedded in the first century context and the agricultural society as well.
And we hear all about these festivals where they all flock to Jerusalem for this or that reason, and we kind of overlook the reasons. At least two of those were tied to wheat and barley harvest time and involved celebration. And tithing involved not money, but involved the produce of the land from the people who raised it. And sheep and shepherds is the other side of that. Some of that has to do with north and south. The grain and the green stuff was up north, but the sheep and the wool and milk and cheeses and yogurts came from Judah, from the southern kingdom. So all that is so thoroughly woven into what we see in the Gospels, you can't help but at least ask questions. And I want to make another point, because you spurred this in my mind earlier. How do you recognize when context is needed? When you're reading the Gospel and something doesn't quite make sense, seems a little off, seems a little illogical, our tendency is to, skip over it. I don't understand that. But what it is a clue. You need to go back forensically and see why that was said, because there is inevitably, there is inherently a good reason for that particular statement.
Yeah, I mean, I'm big on questioning the text. Now, I'm not saying question the validity of the text. That's not what we're talking about here, but asking questions of the text. What is it that I understand? What is it that I don't understand? So if there's a word, a term, a concept, for us, I mean, simply if you're studying a parable like the one we're going to move into talking about a little bit here in a minute, but Matthew 21, when it's the parable of the two sons that the father asked to work in his vineyard. Well, basically what we're doing now is discussing, well, what is a vineyard and what is the significance to the Israelite people of vineyards throughout all of time? And then to begin to read things like Noah planted a garden and a vineyard. That's one of the first acts he did once the flood stopped. So what is important agriculturally? And so to begin to look at the text and enter into the world, contextualists are time travelers, kind of like Marty and Doc from Back to the Future. You know, our goal is to go back in time. We're time travelers. We get into the time machine of context, and we go back a couple of thousand years and identify how did people see, how did people hear and read, what did they see, where are we in the text, what does this look like, and to begin to understand. So a good example of how to do this is to go throughout all the parables that are agricultural and read all of them in preparation to understand any one of them. And you begin to realize that they have themes, like the vineyard owner. Last week we talked about the owner of the vineyard who called laborers in at harvest. Well, right there you get this idea that you need a whole bunch of laborers in your vineyard that you didn't need this whole time, but all of a sudden to bring in the harvest, you need a whole bunch of laborers. So that gives you insight. And this idea that many are laborers and few are landowners. And so we get a socioeconomic reality in the first century that it's the wealthy that are landowners and everyone else is dependent upon the wealthy landowners. And so that parable last week of this man, the laborers in the vineyard, you don't want to offend the landowner. This is, you don't want to bite the hand that feeds you. And in this case of the parable in Matthew 21 of the two sons, the landowner is the father and the two sons are the laborers, and he's asking both of them to do their duty and work in the vineyard. So you begin to get a clear picture of what vineyard reality is and what it looks like to be a worker in the vineyard and what the cultural norms and rhythms of the harvest is and what the expectations are of family members.
So who was Jesus' audience in this parable? It looks just, and again, this is the trick. We didn't go to the parable of the two sons. Really, you don't, when you study that, you go before that and see what has transpired. Who's present? Who's Jesus talking to? And it helps you understand what his point was. In this case, in verse 23, it says, when he entered the temple, the chief priests and the elders of the people came up to him as he was teaching and challenged his authority. Mm. And then
you're right to go early to where Jesus' authority is challenged, because that is the setup, isn't it? That's the context. This is the piece, Jim, that we talked about last week with the parable of the laborers in the vineyard, that we would do well to read what comes before our focal passage and read what comes after. So you're right. You're right on the mark here. Jesus is in the presence of Jewish people, religious leaders, the chief priests, the elders, who are questioning his authority. They say, by what authority are you doing these things? And by the way, that's a contextual giveaway. Religious leaders in the first century are concerned about authority.
Had his audience been his disciples, it might have had a whole different meaning, a different purpose to that parable. So you need to be aware of the environment in which these parables are delivered.
Well, and read Jesus' disciples back into the parable, because Jesus' disciples are present with him, certainly, but so are these religious leaders. And I would venture to say that Jesus' words affect his disciples. So Jesus answered.
He's teaching them all the time, and they must have been very apt, attentive listeners. This would have been kind of a tense setting, and you'd say, let's see what the master does here.
Well, he questions the religious leaders, and this is important because it shows back up in the parable. He says, I'm going to tell you a story. I'm going to ask you a question, and you tell me by what authority I do these things. He says, the baptism of John, where did it come from heaven or from man? So he brings John the Baptist into this, and they discuss it among themselves, and they said, if we say heaven, he will say to us, why didn't we listen to him? Now, I changed the words. It actually says, then why did we not believe him? He'll say, then why did you not believe him? Another way to say it is, why didn't you listen? But if he said from man, we are afraid of the crowd, for they all hold that John was a prophet. So they answered Jesus, we don't know. And he said, neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things. And then he tells the parable. Hmm. He says, what do you think? A man had two sons, and he went to the first and said, son, go work in the vineyard. And he answered, I will not. But afterwards, he changed his mind and went. And he went to the other son and said the same. And he answered, I will go, sir, but did not go. Which of the two did the father's will? And they said the first. In other words, the one who said, I will not, and did, that's the one who did the will of the Father. Why? Because the Jewish people are less concerned by what you say you believe than they are about what you do. Because I can tell what you believe by what you do. Same thing with my parenting of my four kids. If I say to my eldest kid, go do this, and she says, sure, I'll go do this, and she doesn't do it, she's disobeyed me. But if she says, I don't want to, and goes kicking and screaming, but actually does what I say, then, hey, she's obeyed me. But it's not that I heard the sound waves come into my ears and my bones vibrated against my eardrum. No, clearly my daughter hears me when I say, go clean your room. But does she listen? Does she do the thing that I tell her? So, the Jews said this. I mean, Doug has taught around this, Doug Greenwald of Preserving Bible Times. He says that God is what God does. And to the Jewish person, a person is what they do, not what they say. And this is where we get in James, be ye doers of the word, not hearers only, deceiving yourself. This is why Jesus tells the parable of the builders in Matthew 7. He said, a wise man's like the man who builds his house upon the rock. The foolish man is like the man who hears the word but doesn't do it. This man builds upon the sand, but the one who hears the word of God, puts it in practice, this is the person that digs down to bedrock and builds upon a solid foundation. So this is that. And who is Jesus aiming this at? He's aiming it at the Pharisees and the religious leaders who did not listen to John. So that's the context. And then he tells them, he says, truly I say to you, the tax collectors and the prostitutes go into the kingdom of God before you. For John came to you in the way of righteousness, and you did not believe him. Hear it a different way. And you did not hear him. You did not listen to him. You did not obey him. You did not repent at his preaching. But the tax collectors and the prostitutes believed him. And even when you saw it, you did not afterwards change your mind and listen to him or believe him. Now go back to, say, Luke chapter 3 and look at John the Baptist's preaching. Who comes to him? Tax collectors. And they're asking John the Baptist, what shall we do? So in other words, we hear you, so we're going to obey, we're going to repent, we're going to make straight the pathway of the Lord.
And just to note, the tax collectors as a class were the most despised people in Israel. They were traitors to Israel. They worked for the Romans.
And who's in the crowd with Jesus and his disciples?
Levi.
Bingo. Yeah. Mm. And so the example of those who hear and follow are there. The tax collector who is actually following Jesus. As a matter of fact, it's these same religious leaders that said, why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? And they accused Jesus of being a glutton and a drunkard. Well, they're the ones that have heard clearly, and they're not coming to work in the vineyard. The Pharisees and the religious leaders don't listen, but it's the outcast and the tax collector that do.
That's one of the things that's so hard for us to understand about Near Eastern culture is it's what you do that counts, not what you say. Do as I do, not as I say, means a lot. Yeah. Robbie, thank you so much. And this is all in Matthew 21, if you'd like to review it. When things slow down a little bit today, open the Bible, take a look at that and see what you think and apply what we've learned today from Pastor Robbie. I want to mention Preserving Bible Times. Robbie is the executive director, and that's preservingbibletimes.org is the website. And it's being, I should mention that Doug Greenwald, who founded Preserving Bible Times, now has books on Amazon.
Yeah,
on the Kindle editions of all his books now. So that's a place to look if you want some excellent material on biblical context. PreservingBibleTimes.org is the website. And Robbie, thanks so much. We'll see you next week.
Joy and a pleasure, gentlemen. Thank you so much for having me on The Broken Road. Good to be with you.